Well, we'll start. I never, I'm always like, well, it's a comic book show. You start with normal comic book things. So I never know what's going on. Did you watch Loki? I guess that's like the comic-y thing right now.
Yeah, it was actually funny. It's like, wow, these sets look really great. And it's like a real kind of mid-century, late mid-century aesthetic kind of thing. Like, but it also looks like the subway stations in Montreal. Like, I'm looking at
All
the
right.
ceiling lights they have set up, and I'm like, wow, these look like Montreal subway stations. Which, don't get me wrong, Montreal subway stations look great, but that was all I could think of while I was watching that.
Well, is that, I wonder, because I mean, I think most people, especially like 90s and early 2000s, like pretty much any show you can watch is like just Canadian sets and Canadian actors.
Lot I mean a lot of stuff is, but
But
I mean
I know
it's just a
Marvel,
sim
a lot of them moved to like Atlanta, so I was surprised to see like Loki on the Montreal stuff.
Oh, I mean, I don't think it actually was filmed there.
Oh,
It's
was it?
just no. It's just a very similar aesthetic to the TVA sets and the Montreal Metro system.
So have you haven't seen, you have no, still no inkling on what's happening with Taskmaster and Black Widow? They don't give you that.
No, they don't tell me that shit. Yeah, like it's I'll find out when you do, I guess.
No,
I
you
mean
don't get to go to a premiere.
yeah, no. If I made up Black Widow, I still don't think I'd be able to go to the premiere.
That's
But
true.
also, I mean, like, their Taskmaster doesn't have pirate boots, so we don't have a whole lot of crossover as to the movie and the comic that I wrote.
That's true. How was that ending? It's still ending, kind of ending that when it's still not even, it wasn't out. Was that because it was
Yeah.
originally kind of to be coinciding with the movie, correct?
Yeah, it was supposed to come out April 1st of last year, which I think the movie was supposed to come out April of last year, if memory serves. So I think they wanted the series out or like coming out while the movie was coming out. But the movie kept getting pushed back and back, and then Taskmaster, the comic book, the important part, kept getting pushed back and back. And after a certain point, I think everyone's just like, we just got to get this comic out. Like it's been sitting in the tank too long. Let's just, get it out there. One way, like, it still probably benefited from the Black Widow hype because, people are wild for the Marvel movies, and this movie coming out over a year late is just like the anticipation for people is just ramping up and up and up. So I think I mean, again, I don't know, I think Marvel was like, let's take advantage of the anticipation, the fervor that's building up around this movie, and get this comic out so people have something.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, we talked about it when we did Europe. Like, I feel like for most people, like, Taskmaster is like one of those characters who, if you're reading comics, like, and you're a fan of him, I mean, because he's so sparsely used. Like, if you'll go pick up anything. But at the same time, I think if you are like on the periphery and you see, oh, Taskmaster is going to be used in a Black Widow movie, you might pick it up. Like, talked about a bunch of the show. Like, I work one day a week at Barnes Noble for their 40% discount, and I'm in charge of the graphic novel, like, end cap type thing.
Right.
That's pretty much what I fill it. Like, right now, I have like, Black Widow stuff on there, and I think Shang-Chi stuff, and like other stuff. But like, it's a good at least primer to get people in to
Yeah,
hopefully
totally.
other stuff. But I don't think the trade's not out for that yet, right?
No, it's out next month. Yeah, I think it's out next month.
That's pretty good timing then, at least for.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't have a series coming out, having a trade out is the next best thing because I mean, honestly, I think more people are buying trades than individual issues anyway. Like, especially like kind of people are first timers, so they walk into a comic store and they say, "Hey, I want a book with this character I saw in the movie." I'd say 9 times out of 10, the person at the comic shop is going to try to move them a trade.
Yeah, because I mean, you don't want to go in there and be like, here, you could pick up this one thing, but you're gonna have to pick up like this other thing every month for the next like 2 years of your life.
Or yeah, they're like, we want Taskmaster thing. It's like, well, I got issue 4 over there. Yeah, 1 to 3. He's like, no, issue 3 had a new character. What are you crazy? And those people are gonna be like, yeah, well, see you later.
What's like collecting, because I've recently got back into like collecting a lot of, it's for lack of term, better term, manga, and like trying to collect that is like, okay, I want to read this. Well, we have like ish we have like volume 2, 6, 8, and 9,
Yeah,
and like
that's
five
tough.
is out of print, and 7 will be back in stock in August. I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm never gonna read this series.
Yeah, I mean I've been collecting all the Battle Angel stuff, the Alita stuff, and because they had the hardcover slipcase was on Amazon for like just a wild deal the year before last or something. So I got all that for the first series. It was awesome. And I was like, well, I'll collect Last Order as well, you know, the next series. And had these like giant, you know, phone book omnibus. I think the series is like twice as long as the first one. So, you know, I went on eBay and found a great deal on the omnibuses, whatever. And I got them, and then only found out later that the last, like the very end of the series, never got collected in an omnibus. So I had to go track down like the last four, I don't know, tankobons, is that what they're called?
Yeah, tankobons.
Like the small ones. So it looks like dog shit on my shelf, but I got it all.
Yeah, that's like, is it these? I track these down, like the two big, I didn't even know they made a big old manga, and I just found out. So I found a good deal on these two. Come to find out, like, the rest of the series is like $70 a volume. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
That's the thing. Like, I'm waiting to collect the next, or the next or last or whatever, Alita Mars Chronicles. But I don't think there's been a new issue out in a long time. So, or a new chapter, rather. So I'm kind of waiting. I'm like, oh, it's not an omnibus. I don't know if I want to buy the tankobons, but I'm not really sure what's happening. So I guess we'll see what happens. But until then, like, I subscribe to the Jump app, which is awesome.
Yeah, that thing's like crazy.
It's like $2 a month, and it's just, you know, a staggering library of you know comics. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, and it's the only downside is because then it, like, the weird, like, OCD collector in me is like, it's like I've been reading Chainsaw Man, and they're ahead. They're obviously ahead. So, like, I'm like, oh, I could read ahead, but then I'm like, I still got to buy that when it comes out. So I'm like buying something I've already read. But yeah, like, it's insane. Like, there is literally like 60 or whatever years of history, like, on that app. You can just read stuff. You could never get bored reading it.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, I mean, I think I read what, like 600 chapters of One Piece. Like, I started from the first and just like kept ripping through up until the first storyline after the time jump, and kind of lost me. Something about the time jump I didn't care for, but even still, like, that's years and years of comics that, you know, just ripping through. And then, like, well, it's good, you know, I'll go read something else. Like, you know, Golden Kamuy is just, or Kamui, or however you pronounce it. Can't read that one on mobile. You have to read it on your computer. But yeah, it's like, it's so good. It's just, there's so much stuff there for like $2 a month. It's an outrageous deal.
Yeah. Well, it's like, because I bought the first One Piece box set, which, again, it's great, but now I got to get like six more of them, or however many they exist. And also, like, it thinks fucking huge. I don't know where to put it.
Yeah, but, man, you got to get another bookshelf.
Yeah. Well, I was going to get another house, or like evict my kids.
I mean, you know, if you take long enough to collect it, they'll have moved out by then.
That's true. It's their college funds in there. But one thing I know is on, what is it? I don't even know. The Marvel U app. What is it called? The Marvel?
Unlimited.
Unlimited, which I would sign up for at some point, but is, and I'm going to start with, normally because you were the guest, I would start with your greatest comic book of all time that you read this week. But after reading yours, I feel like yours is the greatest comic book of all time that I read this week. But so I am going to start with, what the fuck, I don't know how to do the cameras. My pick is The Amazing Spider-Man, Spirits of Earth by Charles Vess, which I believe was 1990. And it was like in that wave of graphic novels they were doing. I didn't hear about this until maybe last year or something. I don't know. I saw like a page on maybe like a Tumblr or something, and it looked sick. So I tracked it down on eBay, and I finally got around to reading it maybe like 2 weeks ago or so. But we do this like every other week. So I was like, had you heard of this before?
No, I hadn't heard about it until you brought it up. A lot of that kind of like Marvel original graphic novel stuff is a real blind spot for me. So I picked up a few here and there. What was a good one that I read recently? Night Raven, House of Cards, which was, I think, a Marvel UK one. But it was, David Lloyd did it, and it was like another fully painted book. It's just like amazing. It's I think it's the best David Lloyd stuff I've ever seen. And similarly here, like it was amazing to see Charles Vest just doing like a whole ass Spider-Man. And it was such like, it's such a characteristic of his work. It was, you can never look at that and be like, oh yeah, like that's just a generic sort of, you know, Charles Vess Spider-Man kind of thing. Like, it's wild.
Yeah, well, even I didn't know he did share the screen. He, because I guess like in 86, this, the thing I'm showing now, he did a backup. And okay. It was like Cry of the Wendigo.
And, oh, okay. There you go. Now you're speaking my language. That's
I don't know why the Wendigo, I don't know why he's in New York City, but so he didn't color this, but.
Because somebody got hungry. That's why.
Yeah. It's like about like a little girl that gets kidnapped and like Peter Parker goes out there. But like his Spider-Man is like fucking great. Like, and you see it in Spirits of the Earth, like his kind of like transition, but like he's like really good. And I think it has to do kind of probably with his like fantasy background. But he's like really good at like acting characters out. They feel very dramatic and like over the top. And you see that a lot in this book. It's a quick rundown of it because it is like a one shot and it's pretty, I would say the only, and I would say like the only downside, it's pretty, I would say it's a pretty like standard, like three arc story is the beginning, the middle and the end. And that, and it's kind of what you want. Like I saw people like criticizing it for that and I was reading reviews, but the idea is Spider-Man goes on a honeymoon, a second honeymoon. I don't know where their first was with Mary Jane. To Scotland, specifically, what's the town? I don't know, some Scottish name. She gets like very, it's very like Scooby-Doo-esque. She gets a letter from her aunt that she has a castle that she needs to go, or no, she has a cottage that she has to kind of, she has to go kind of like take care of and kind of sort out. So they go there while Spider-Man's there, hijinks ensue, that there's like these ghosts or fairies that the town is kind of dealing with, and there's kind of like a weird mystery that culminates in a very of the time mystery. Like I don't want to say Scooby-Doo in a demeaning way, because I love Scooby-Doo and I kind of love the setup of that. And Vess's idea was originally like taking Spider-Man out of his element. And in the back of this hardcover, there's like a 4-page essay where he would just go visit and hang out in Scotland. He loved it. So he was there and he's like, what would it be like if I set a superhero story here? And then what's her name? Duffy. What's her name? Joda. She's the editor. Was one of the editors at Marvel that approached him about writing it. And so he initially kind of got the idea. But I think like in the way these kind of graphic novels that Marvel was doing, and much like DC at the time with like, you know, Gotham by Gaslight or like Gothic, Morrison's Gothic and stuff like that. Like I wish they would do more of the type of stuff where you kind of give it to a specific creator. I mean, this is a guy who does like fantasy books and works with occasionally like Gaiman, and he's then able to like essentially put his twist on Spider-Man. And that's what you kind of get. Like, it's not, you know, it's not groundbreaking plot-wise and character-wise, but at the same time, like, it's not something you've seen. Like, you don't really explore kind of, like, Gaelic Gothic mystery with Spider-Man to kind of him in a castle setting with Ghost, and then, spoiler, eventually, the Hellfire Club. That was great. Like, that twist is fucking great, because, like, that's not, I wouldn't have expected Hellfire Club.
No. I thought it was going to be, like, I don't know. Like, I saw the setup. I was like, oh, I don't know. I was going to be like Hydra or something. But you saw that then the first guards turn up with those awesome, like, Hellfire masks.
Yeah.
Hellfire Club masks. I'm like, shit, yeah, now we're talking. I'm like, this has gone in a way I did not expect. And I mean, you know, given the time period, maybe it would be a little more obvious then, given that, you know, the X-Men were hot shit in those days. Well, I mean, they still are. But I was like, who is this? Is it going to be like Hydra? Is it going to be AIM? Or like, who's behind this? It's like, oh no, baby, it's a Hellfire Club.
And like, you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because like Hellfire Club is like old, like English, like, you know, white royalty. So to take like a Scottish baron type figure, and they have this, it's like, again, this like ludicrous plot where there's this crystal that manipulates energy and can destroy anything on Earth, and like that's his end to the Hellfire Club. Like,
yeah,
it seems like a, like, again, it kind of seems like a silly, like, three arc story, but in the end, like, I think it's like very smart way to bring Spider-Man not only to Scotland, but to kind of tie it to this like larger lore of it, and then also then tie it into like your current day, not well, current day of 1990s,
yeah,
like Marvel lore. Like, I think it's brilliant. I don't necessarily know kind of, again, why this, I didn't hear about it till last year, or also like, and why they don't take more chances with these creator owned books. But at the time they were bankrupt, so maybe that's why.
Yeah, probably for paying Charles Vest to paint an entire comic book. But yeah, like the thing about that, and you know, the sort of, you know, this idea that there's a giant crystal under the ground, it's never really explained, you know, where it came from. But like, thing is, it doesn't need to be, because ultimately this is a comic, and like, you know, I say this as the highest compliment, it's something that's really self-indulgent. You know, Charles Vest is like, I love the Scottish Highlands, I want to put Spider-Man in the Scottish Highlands, to have this, like you said, like very lush, very rich sort of gothic story. And there's something I really like about that. Like, you know, a lot of times when people use the term self-indulgent for a creator working out their vision or things that they really like, that's often what I really like about something, because you really get a feeling, not just, you know, for the characters in the story, not just for the setting in the story, but you really get a feeling of, for the people behind the story, like the people making it. And that's what I really got here. And that's one of the things I really liked about it.
Yeah, I've always said, and I think even to, I want to say treadly, I guess, like with the idea of like the Snyder cut, not necessarily something I needed or per se wanted, but like, I would much rather watch something like that, where it's, you know, a whole artist vision of something, and it'd be terrible. I'd rather watch that, and much like this, where, like, you know, I would rather stories be completely kind of bathed in the essence of the creator, and then you really get kind of their enjoyment out of it. I much prefer, like, I think of anyone, I like to read stories when it's clear the creator is enjoying writing it, versus kind of like a struggle to write it, which is why, like, on the show we've covered a lot of, like, I've tried to pick like tie-ins to series that I've really enjoyed. Like, we did the KFC DC crossovers, because those books are fucking great. And my argument is always like, there are no bad tie-in. Like, obviously, if you're a creator and like you have to write a tie-in, and you would probably know better than me per se, but like, you know, you get tasked with writing.
I've written a few.
A King in Black tie-in, like obviously, like, you know, that might not be part of your plan, but there's something there you can tackle. So it's no like excuse. Like, you, it's a creative thing, and like, so I always like to see like when creators take that initiative. And we've done that a lot on that, and like, this is much like that, where like, you know, tell your own story however you want. I'd much rather read that than something completely kind of average across the board.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is too, when you read this book, it's like, you know, no one's gonna say this is like, you know, Kraven's Last Hunt. This is not like a classic Spider-Man story, but it, I think it is a very distinct and interesting piece of art. And part of that is, you, like, you can just feel how much skin Vest has in the game. You know, he's committed to doing this thing about something he loves, which is, you know, this location. And like, the, you know, he's got these big castles. Like, basically, if you have a guy who's making an entire comic book based on how much he likes this location, you know, he's never going to skimp on the backgrounds, you know.
Right.
Except, yeah, also his Spider-Man is like super gnarly, the way he moves.
Yeah.
And there's one shot when he's tangling with the Hellfire guys, and he just looks horrifying. Like, his legs are pulled up and his hands are stuck out. And like, his webbing is really gross looking.
Yeah, and I don't think I got it in this one. Yeah, but there's a couple of times where he like webs up either Hellfire guys and the two kind of crooks that open it. Yeah, and it's like, I don't, it's not body horror, but it's like gross, like the amount of like webbing that he uses.
That's something I always kind of, it's not really anything I really touch on ever, and you know, probably never will. But it was a thought I always had about Spider-Man, like way back in the day, where like, he's got to be kind of gross for people to look at, like the way he moves and like the stuff he does. It was something that came up in that comic book Desolation Jones, where there's a character who was altered to have what they called an arachnid reflex, where she was just deeply unsettling to all the people around her. And I was like, I always kind of wonder if Like, are people grossed out by Spider-Man? Like, we kind of touched on that in the second issue of Black Cat, where they're like, does he wear a mask because he has a spider face? And it was like, oh, he's gross, he's Spider-Man.
Right, well, you think of, like, the iconic poses for Spider-Man are all these, like, very beyond, like, like, they're almost like that famous Spider-Woman cover, Minara. Yeah.
But I mean, like, you're looking at that, like, McFarlane, like, really contortion kind of stuff, which is, like, super dynamic and exciting on comic page. But it is funny to think about it, like, looking at it from the perspective of a normal person. Like, he would just be a really strange dude.
Yeah. And then, yeah, and like I said, I think he, in this particular, because there's only, there's probably three real scenes of, no, four real scenes of action. There's, like, the open, there's him fighting a giant ghost. Which again is only, which is only explained by we have a crystal.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah,
which but, again, it's just an excuse. So like, he's like, I want to draw a bunch of ghosts. I want to draw a giant ghost chasing Spider-Man through a castle, and then like, he blows a pillar, like a tower over, because he's so pissed off. Like, what's the explanation? Holograms? Sure, why not? You know?
Yeah. And yeah. And I again, I hate using, I don't know why. Maybe it's because my kids watch Scooby-Doo and the Loch Ness Monster constantly. But it's very much like that. Like, you know, at the end of the mystery, oh, how did I do it? I did projections and holograms. Well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't fucking matter. Like, it,
that's a thing.
In the context of the story, it works, and it works for what you're telling. So like, why, it looked fucking cool.
Yeah, and like that's the thing about superhero comics that, I mean, like here's the thing, like in Black Cat and Taskmaster, for instance, I do a lot of stories with like plans, you know, it's always like who's got the better plan, who's better prepared, but ultimately it's only set dressing because it just has to sound good enough. Ultimately, I don't care if something makes a whole lot of sense because it's comic books. If it makes just enough sense, then it's fine. Then it's still exciting for people to see, and you know, it's fun. You don't need, like, you know, I can't do an entire issue where they're just getting together all the gear they need in order to do a job, you know, unless that is itself an exciting story. And it's the same thing with this. It's like, well, I want to draw a castle. I want to draw a bunch of ghosts, and I want to draw Spider-Man getting in a tight situation. How do we explain that? Holograms. Fuck it. We're good. We're done. We're set. Time to break up the watercolors, you know?
And I think, too, like, if this is a, for the most part, like a one shot, like it works in the sense, again, where everyone I think can pick it up. Like, he does enough in the beginning to establish Spider-Man in New York City. I think anyone with a general understanding of New York City gets the fish out of water sense of going to Scotland. I think he does a great job of establishing a relationship with Peter and Mary Jane. I thought it was a pretty good.
Oh yeah, totally.
Like, it's a pretty good Mary Jane, I mean, outside of her getting decked in the face, which you don't see, I guess, but, like, it's just, like, casually on the way up, like, did he hit you? Yeah, yeah, okay.
I mean, to be fair, that guy was a piece of shit, so.
Yeah.
I mean, there were no, excuse the term, punches pulled in establishing that Angus was a real piece of shit and deserves whatever he's got coming.
Yeah, and I like that, like, again, there's no misdirect throughout either, like, it's literally, like, yeah.
As soon as you see him, it's like Mary Jane hustles him at a pool, and then he gets mad, and like you're like, there he is, there's the bad guy.
Yeah,
he turns up with a little bow in his hair, and you're like, there's the bad guy, Hellfire Club, baby.
Yeah, I love that he brought out the garb. And there was like one, I didn't pull the panel, but there's like one where it's after she beats him playing pool, and it's only like he does so much work in the background.
Oh yeah,
and it's like literally like. I think Mary Jane is like kind of like leaning on Peter, and she has like her arm up, and it's like the way they're like kind of like holding each other. It's like the most natural like relationship pose. And again, the idea of like bringing in this fantasy painter is able to kind of get stuff that I don't think you would normally get in comics. And that's what I think makes this so interesting. Again, he did a backup, and I think he did another one. He's done a few painted covers. But outside of that, he hasn't really done, I think he did stuff with Gaiman.
Yeah.
And that's it. He's pretty active still. He is a very cool looking 7-year-old. If you go to his website,
I was surprised. Like, I'm not super familiar with Vest. Like, I read Stardust, the one he did with Neil Gaiman, but I was surprised at like the similarities to Kaluda. Which, I mean, I guess I probably shouldn't have been surprised if I'd known anything about him. But yeah, it has that same sort of, it's almost like a contradiction. It's like a certain delicacy of line, but also an almost comic exaggeration of characterization, where like people's eyes get really big or their faces distort, but at the same time it's like really delicate and masterful
Yeah,
that I was really, really charmed by.
I felt like this was like the closest we, because I mean Charles Vess, even though he's a fantasy guy, I think he's from like Pennsylvania or Virginia or something, but has a very, I think he is obsessed and studies kind of like the very classic fairy tale storybook style that was developed in Europe, and he has a very European feel,
Oh yeah.
and at times. Like, especially Angus when he has the ponytail, I was like, this is probably the closest we would have come to like a Mobius like doing a Spider-Man, like obviously not as detailed or I
You're
don't
just
know.
saying that because he's got the same ponytail as John from
Yeah,
Angel.
but I was like, this is like as close as we could ever get to that, which again would have, I mean, we have what, Requiem, or no, what's that called, Silver Surfer.
Parable?
Parable,
Silver
yeah,
Surfer. Yeah.
but yeah, and
Makes me think though, like how much did Kaluta do any Marvel work? Like I know he did a bunch of DC stuff with like Shadow, but I can't think off the top of my head if he did any Marvel stuff.
not that I can think of. I feel like, again, like late 80s and 90s, like a lot of people slept under the radar. Like, again, I didn't know he did a backup, and it is literally only a backup
Yeah.
in it's an issue with, I don't know. Someone else is writing. Oh, here it is. Shooter and Ron Frenz were the writer penciler, but then he just did like this like 4 or 5 page backup in it, which now I'm trying to track down a copy on eBay. But
What issue was it?
it is 277. The mystery
ASM.
of the Hobgoblin deepens
Yeah.
with, I think there's like daredevils in it or something. I skimmed it. It was okay. I'd be reading it like for the backup, being like, what the fuck am I getting? Ron Frenz, no offense, but like,
But yeah, like as far as like I'm just thinking kind of like standout images. Like his opening in New York was so good. Like it was the narration was, spot on, talking about, Spider-Man, like the joy of being Spider-Man, of like, ripping around in the air, going through the skyline. Like his city illustrations were so good. But also at the end, that like complex with the giant crystal and like the trucks coming in and out of it was amazing. Like he's not someone I associate with a lot of urban or like industrial style illustrations. And man, it looked amazing.
yeah, like his ability to kind of switch between the two, because I love the like kind of like energy cage he has them,
Yeah.
like a great movement.
At first it was really striking because at first it looked like a glass cylinder basically that was had been streaked with blood. But yeah, that was very gnarly.
Yeah, there's a good amount of blood in this, and there's, it's only in the hardcover. I can't find a page for it. Like, I didn't know where it is in the series, but like
Wow.
it's just
But
like,
I mean that's the kind of stuff I expect him to do well.
yeah,
It's like the more urbanized or like industrial stuff that really surprised me. Because I mean, like I see like the rolling highlands, the pastoral greens and whatnot, and like, well, yeah, shit, that's who he is, that's what he does. But it's the stuff that I'm surprised by that I think really struck me.
yeah and I like the one other thing he did. It's like, I don't know if I've seen this, maybe it has, like
Oh yeah, that's great. I've never seen that before.
that Spider-Man eye, like, because I've seen people use that, but I don't know, I ever think I've ever seen Peter's eye within the
No,
Spider-Man.
like I always think about like the half mask they used to do, or like they do in the newspaper Spider-Man strip a lot. But I thought those were really it was a really neat idea, and I'd love to see it again.
Yeah. I mean, and apparently he's 70 and still going strong. He does work. So maybe.
Is he joining us on the stream?
Oh, no, I should have tried.
Yeah.
Although
That would be amazing.
I mean, he looks, so yeah, if you picture like a fantasy illustrator in their 70s, like you pull up a picture of him on his website, it is like legit, like what you expect. Unlike if you search for Jed McKay and you go on your Wikipedia and it's some guy.
I don't think I have a Wikipedia.
Well, so you do. Well, you don't.
Oh, somewhere. The other Jed McKay does. Yeah.
But it has your picture.
Wait, does it?
It does on Google, at least when you like do the Google search for it.
That's hilarious. Because, yeah, he's got my Ninja Turtles IMDb credit, which I really got to get sorted out.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, because there's only one Jed McKay on IMDb, and he's got my Ninja Turtles credit. Which, I mean, right. You know, it's not the world's biggest deal or anything. It's not like he did it. But I'm like, oh, yeah, I should get that sorted out sometime if I ever intend to work in TV again.
Yeah, well, let me share this quick. It's a little picture, but you see it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, man, that fucking picture. It's going to haunt me till the day I die.
I mean, you can't do any local papers. No.
I mean, yeah. What are you going to do?
But like I said.
Oh, yeah, Charles Vest, man. He looks like he's having a good time.
Yeah, man, he's got a sweet necklace.
Yeah, hell yeah. Yeah.
And again, and like again, the cover for this is like very great. It's got this like screaming
Spider-Man in some ruins, screaming ghost. Like, come on, forget it.
And I don't know why it's not done more. And I think that was like one of the first things I remember. What's the first MCU Spider-Man? Homecoming. What's the first?
Oh Spider-Man? Yeah. Homecoming.
There's like the part where he's in like the suburban. Queens.
Yeah. And there's no like buildings to swing off.
Yeah, and he's like pissed that he has to run. Like that shit's great, and you don't see it too often. Yeah. But
you see in this where he's in like a little Scottish village. He's like, the highest building here is a church. Like I can't get away. And I was like, oh no. The first time he suits up, he goes up to that castle to look around. You just see Spider-Man walking around, and it looks so wrong.
Yeah.
He's just like, man, this sucks. Like I can't swing around. I actually have to walk. Walk like a normal ass person.
Yeah, and he gets and he still has him like quipping to himself, or he's like quipping with ghosts. Like,
yeah,
it's pretty good. But
did you notice that the armpit webs keep appearing and disappearing?
Yeah, I did. I didn't notice, and I don't know. Again, if that was like a thing at the time, it like was the mandate or what? I've never decided if I enjoyed them or not. But
yeah, you know what? I'm on the fence. I don't really know. Like, I think I'm probably more on the side of against than for, but it's not like a hill I'm willing to die on. But it just was funny because I saw them pop up in a panel. I'm like, well, that's odd. I don't recall that. And the next panel, they're gone. And the next panel, they're back. So I guess that's a way of, like, making everybody happy.
Yeah, they show up a lot when he's running through the town. I was trying to see if he was using them when they would be necessary. If they have, logically, they don't have real purpose.
Yeah. But yeah, like I've only noticed it in like the fight with the Hellfire Goons, and I was like, oh wow, I didn't notice that. And then the next panel, it doesn't have them anymore. I'm like, all right, I guess there's a lot of inner conflict when this is being created. But yeah, back to your point, I would love to see I'd love to see the Marvel graphic novel series continue again, ideally people with a very specific vision that they want to bring out there. I just don't know. Cause, I mean, I guess it must have been relatively marketable in the 80s because they did a whole whack of them. Like,
yeah, and again, they were like actively seeking them out, at least from what I was reading. And like with him, she went to him and was like, "What if I gave you a graphic novel with any character, what would you do?" Yeah. And he's like, "Oh, let me think about it." And he had his trip to Scotland, and then he was talking about how he grew up with Spider-Man, so he just saw the two would merge. The idea that they would kind of like approach creators with very specific visions seems interesting. And they kind of did it. They had that Marvel Knights initiative, which I loved.
Yeah. That's true.
So they had like the Bram Revell X-Men. They had Matt Kent's Spider-Man with Marco Rudy, and then Joe Keating. And oh, shoot, what's that guy? He does tons of art.
And he was drawing a comic. I would assume he would do tons of art.
Yeah, he did Sex with Joe Casey. I can't think of his name. He has a very distinct style.
I can think of the style immediately, but I can't remember who specifically it is.
Yeah, but at least those were like, here's stories out of context. Like you can do whatever you want with them and tell your own unique things. And like that Matt Kent Spider-Man is insane. And I think that Bram Revell's X-Men is like one of the best like one-shot X-Men stories that exists. And like,
I think one of the problems is though that people, like a lot of comic fans, are just really obsessed with things mattering, with things like with continuity. I feel like the minute you say that something is not in continuity, you get a huge swath of people just checking out.
Right, because I think like, then people feel like it doesn't. There's no way to it, which there is
exactly
story wise.
Yeah, I mean that's it's just it's a common, I'm not gonna say a complaint or common conflict, but it's certainly something that does factor in when you're creating something. Is people have a very specific need for the things they read to matter, whatever that actually means to them. Usually, it means, is this going to impact the main comic? Is this going to be something part of the larger shared story? Where something like Spider-Man Spears of the Earth will not. But does that mean it's a bad story? No. Does that mean it's not worth your time? Absolutely not. However, that's something I think that doesn't really communicate to a lot of people when you're getting that across. Like, you know, Death of Doctor Strange got announced this week. The first thing people are asking me is this in the main continuity? Is this, you know, 616 going to matter? And for the record, it will. It is.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. And it's, again, that's, and I think as a fan, it is that instance, like understanding it as a business as much as it is anything else. And like last greatest comic book episode, we did the wrap up to, we did the second half of Axe of Swords, which I thought was fantastic because like it undermined the whole build up. I think that event is brilliant because again, like the idea that X-Men have to collect 10 swords to fight, and then when you get to the actual fight, there's no sword fighting, when the swords don't matter, and there's like dancing and all that stuff. And like I think that is great, but again, like you can't, I don't, then you run the risk of again either not mattering or mattering too much to the people who are reading it and circumventing all this stuff. And like, but at the same
time,
oh god.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
but, you know, going back to think on that, there's no reason that this can't be in continuity because, like, I'm thinking back to the Marvel graphic novels, you know, the Marvel original graphic novels that I've read, like the ones that are set in the Marvel universe. I'm pretty sure they're meant to be in continuity. Like, you know, Spirits of the Earth is not going to change anything,
right?
But it's something that exists, and if you wanted to call back to it, you certainly could. Like, there's nothing that would stop you outside of, you know. Someone say like, you know, this is extremely difficult for people to find. I'm not really sure why you want to reference it. But like, I think back to the, like, you know, Dazzler the movie, that could still exist. I mean, terrible. I hated Dazzler the movie. But, you know, it was there. You know, Fury, Black Widow, Death Duty. It's, as far as I know, it exists in continuity if you want it to. But people aren't exactly lining up to reference a comic book of Fury and the Black Widow teaming up to deal with Night Raven, you know?
Right.
So, like, I don't like think there's well, yeah, there you go.
Right. Yeah, you could, again, it is, I think doing that then obviously kind of, again, in that sense, it, I don't know if it like neuters creators, but at the same time, it would anyway, because like, I mean, it's comics, like you can't necessarily kill Spider-Man. And if you do, does it really matter anyway? Like,
yeah, I mean, pretty much every what if kills Spider-Man.
Yeah, so
it's a grand tradition.
At the same time, I mean, the Hellfire, is that gala still going on? We don't actually see a body of Angus, so.
I mean, that's very true. He just leaped into the ocean, or the earth, rather. I love the Hellfire Club goon outfit. It's so good.
It's like one of the best. Yeah, it's like one of the best designs. For Goon specifically.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, I would say original Hydra outfit is like right up there because it's, you know, spectacular. The kind of like robe drapey one, forget about it. And then like the kind of like the weird like pouchy bulldog jowl mask is great. Oh, yeah. But yeah, after that, it's Hellfire Goons all the way.
Yeah. And I like these. I like that they had like just very basic banter. Like, I don't like being in a cave. Like, I wish we could go up.
It's like, this sucks. Have we cleared everybody out of this friggin' village yet? And like, don't worry. We're using our greatest weapon, capitalism.
Right. And then they just get beat up by Spider-Man. But it is available. I'm about 80% to 90% sure it's available on the Marvel Unlimited app, but you can easily go track. Like, I mean, this copy is more beat up than I like to think about, because the more I think about it, I'm like, oh, I wish I had a better, like, but
so I decided to put this in the search list.
Yeah, but you can easily get it on Amazon if you want, Amazon or eBay. But I don't know, for me, well, up until I read Jed's pick, this was the greatest comic book of all time that I read this week. But I will let Jed introduce his pick, which...
All right. All right, so my pick for the greatest comic book I read this week is, more accurately, the greatest comic book I reread this week, but it is Hobtown Mystery Stories, The Case of the Missing Men. It is by Chris Burton and Alexander Forbes, both from Nova Scotia, where I live. It's published by Conundrum Press, which is a Nova Scotia print. And it is a original graphic novel, which is relatively hefty. So, yeah, you had your reading cut out for you. But, yeah, it's basically, it's set in Nova Scotia in a small town in 1996. I grew up in Prince Edward Island, and a province just a little ways over, still a maritime province. And basically this like 90s maritime dirtbag dipshit kid energy is so extremely relatable to me. And just like, you know, smoking in bowling alleys and like, you know, people drinking bad beer and like towns coming together for like weird sort of bullshit celebrations. It worked for me on every level. But beyond that, it's just a really spectacular blend of the sort of kid detective genre with real horrifying, unsettling shit.
Yeah.
What did you think of this, Alex?
When you mentioned I had never heard of it, which for me is like the best part of the show. Often my regular co-host, Jack, we both try and pick things that either of us haven't heard, which is, again, I'm always out for buying more stuff. So when I saw that it was like 300 and so pages, I was like, okay, I'll try and get through this. I started it. I was halfway through within like an hour or so, and I just wanted to read more, and I finished it.
It goes fast, doesn't it?
Yeah. And like, so, I mean, all cards on the table. I didn't have a copy. I have ordered one now, but so I reached out to Conundrum and also Chris, and both were very nice to provide me review copies. And they gave me a review copy of the next one. It's like the...
Are you talking about The Case of the Cursed Hermit?
Yeah. So like the second I finished this, I was like, oh, I got to read that. But I was like, I got to get ready for the show. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, it is the... I think they describe it as like Lynch meets Nancy Drew.
Yeah.
Which I think on the surface, very much, I think is a good, if you kind of like elevator pitch, but it...
Yeah, for sure.
It does what I think a lot of media now tries to do, like your Riverdales and like even they've redone Nancy Drew, try to capture the essence of those kid detectives.
Yep.
Much in a more realistic setting, this less so, but kind of the edginess of it. I think this is like the best adaptation of that I've ever read.
Oh, absolutely.
The kids are not only relatable, and again, I didn't grow up in Nova Scotia in this setting, but like just the capturing the true kind of angst of kids and the kind of cadence and relationships, I think were brilliant. But then also to mix in the kind of abstract weirdness that like the Lynch reference is doing, and it worked completely, is insane. Yeah. Like this on every level, like the mystery is great, the weirdness is great, and then just kind of like the relationships with the kids are great. Like there's, and that's not even like touching on the art, which is fucking fantastic. Like every page is like a cover of a classic, like Nancy Drew Hardy Boys book. It's fucking great.
Yeah, like it's one of those things where usually for, you know, a book like this, the cover is going to be the best part. And like, I don't think it's a knock on the book to say the cover is the worst part, where like everything between these two covers is amazing. Like it's just such great work that is so, it's just so like evocative and like smart, and just it tells you everything, you know, like the pages you have there, that's the first like what, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's the first 5 pages before the book even starts. And that was what sold me on the book. It's like, wow, this is just like horrifying and weird and unpleasant. And then you get into the actual book, and yeah, it's, I don't know, I don't have enough good things to say about the Hobtown mystery stories. Like I said to you, I don't know why everyone in the world isn't talking about them.
Yeah, and I don't know if, like, I mean, I was familiar with Conundrum, but yeah, I don't know if, again, it's a smaller publisher trying to get that into shops, but this feels like a book that kind of in the current market would sell like crazy. Like it feels very much of the time, but doing it better than, again, anything I've read. Yeah, like this cold open is so great at establishing the tone.
You have the next page on there?
I don't know. I tried to use only the previews. No, I have this.
Okay, that's fine. But yeah, like the next page is just amazing. You know, the guys in the raincoats with the paper plate masks with the childlike dog drawings on them. Like it's reminiscent of the best kind of scenes from horror manga. Mm. Like that kind of, those are like, you know, moments of quiet menace that, you know, you look at it and everything, your skin crawls, your brain's like, yeah, this is a situation that is really not great. And there's going to be a physical reaction.
And it takes these kids who are, well, all in high school minus Sam, which again, I love the weirdness of he is a graduate and they don't really ever, like.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically like Tom Swift, you know, except Tom Swift, everybody just sort of takes him at face value. Whereas here in this like little town in rural Nova Scotia, there's like, oh no, he's just some dipshit kid. He's like, no, seriously, yeah. I'm taking courses at MIT. Like, yeah, right, sure.
Yeah, but they're all like, I don't know how to describe it without, because again, this I don't want to ruin at all. Spoilers wise, no Hellfire Club shows up, but fairly, I mean, surprisingly similar like tones, kind of in the mystery. Larger.
I mean, again, this is like another extension of a Scooby-Doo mystery, just in a very different direction than the Spider-Man we talked about.
Yeah, but it addresses, again, the weirdness, again, like the very kind of Twin Peaks moments, but everyone kind of reacts to them how you would actually react to them outside of the town. Like the kids are very realistic, but at the same time, there's like this, the normal mystery baked into it, and like, there's so many layers in this book, and I love the books where you can kind of read this and get the very baseline bare minimum out of it. Like you can kind of get this like cool kid mystery.
Yeah.
But like if you want to read it again and there's like these deeper things in it, like the town, everyone in the page, like there's not like a wasted space on the page. Everyone's doing something. Like even for a very kind of I don't want to say cartoonesque, but like the style they're going for in this, like everyone emotes very well. Like the reactions in this are fantastic. The kid reactions, like there's a lot of like very timed comedic moments.
Oh, and yeah, absolutely.
So there's like, it's so nuanced and so layered as you read through it. Like, again, you can get a couple of reads out of it and you can kind of get what you want out of it. At the same time, I think anyone could pick it up and get kind of the bare minimum of a mystery out of it.
Yeah, I mean, like something I noticed when I reread it again this week is, you know, all these fucking towny weirdos, and this kid always stuck with me is the kid who's always wearing a motorcycle helmet.
Oh yeah.
And like he just keeps popping up here and there. I think he actually gets a name in the next one and you see his mom or something. But it's not something that's ever addressed or mentioned. It's just, yeah, here's this kid that's always wearing, you know, like a 70s motorcycle helmet, or like probably, you know, like a snowmobile helmet, given that it's in, you know, rural Canada. But like all the characters, like the five main kid detectives are so well characterized, but they're never done so in a way that makes them seem like a, you know, a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has, you know, just really great moments, and they're characterized well and they're acted well. You kind of see what's beneath them, you know, Dana's the rich kid who's, you know, very smart and takes the mystery stuff very seriously, but maybe might be a little manipulative. No one, you're not really, really sure. You know, Pauline's the poor kid who's got the, you know, some unknown family situation and, you know, some sort of strange thing going on. And, you know, Brennan and Denny, and Brennan's like, you know, very stolid and very, very serious, and Denny's just kind of a dipshit. He's the, he's the guy that gets the jokes, and it all just comes together so well.
Yeah, they all get, like you said, that they all get kind of their moment to shine, but I think the kind of very real attention to everyone gets a clear arc. I don't think anyone is where they are when they start this. Like you said, it's very new, with Dana, I think specifically, kind of nuanced in not only her arc, but again, the characterization of her. I think there's the moment where, I don't know if it's following, I don't want to spoil the dogs, but there's he's a very disheveled and crying. And at that point, it's kind of broken down and real moment for that. And you get those really great arcs. And then also even within the story, he switches up time. He switches up how he approaches the storytelling throughout it. It's broken down in the chapters. I don't know. I think this is next level storytelling. And I'm really surprised that it's not something bigger. And I'm very, very angry that
it's wild, isn't it? I picked it up because, I've seen this on the shelf at the comic store for, ages. I just never bothered to pick it up. So I was I didn't know what to expect from it. And I thought it was just going to be kind of, you know how people print local histories, the vanity press to print local histories of where you are or whatever. I thought it might be something like that. I was like, I don't know. I just don't really know if this is something I'm going to be interested in. It just really went under my radar until I saw on Twitter, someone had said, here's this book. And they basically posted the first five pages out of that cold open. And it was immediately sold because this looks spectacular. Those five pages sold me entirely on this book and any other book that will come after it. So, I went down to the comic store. I bought the first two books just, on the strength of those five pages, because that told me everything I need to know. I know there's going to be great art. I know it's going to be some, very weird shit. And what I got was even better than what I expected based on it. So yeah, I would love these books to get out there. I'm not saying that adaptations, and stuff like that are the be all and end all, but I have no idea why Netflix hasn't bought this, right. Cause they can make it for a song, but, and again, I don't care about adaptations, but I do like to see people making money off the things that they've created.
Yeah. Well, it's, you look at the boom of kind of the 80s nostalgia and Stranger Things that. And again, those are fun stories, but I don't think it is captured as well as this. And
no, it doesn't have a patch on it.
And I don't know how, when I had reached out to Chris, I was if you have a copy available. And then about 100 pages in, I DM'd him and was like, holy fuck, I'm so sorry that I've never heard of this. This is the greatest fucking thing I've read. It's so good.
Yeah. And it's just there's just such moments of quiet horror in it. Like we were talking about before, at the farmhouse, before the dogs turned up, when they find the farmhouse, and it's such a moment, and it's just, it hits so hard. Similarly, when they actually track down, the titular missing men, you see what happened to them, and it's just absolutely horrifying. And then, the whole last action sequence is just, it's so scary. It's so it's so brutal, and it's not something that's relying on, big crazy monsters or, weird ghosts and stuff like that. It's just something that's horrifying. Or, similarly, the whole last
and bit. And I think,
the last
bit. It's such a, what's that?
Oh, no, I say the last bit at the school. And again, you mentioned before, the way it's kind of cut through time, where you have that whole chapter where it's the news reporter is coming there in the aftermath. He's talking to people, trying to figure out what happened. And then only out through the course of that do we see what happened during that time. And it was just, it's so well done. And it's one of those things where, as a comic book writer, I'll read a lot of comic books, and there'll be times I'll look at something and say, oh yeah, I could do that, or I could do that better, or no, I couldn't do that. But this is something where I'm like, yeah, I couldn't do that. This is something that's beyond my ability. And I have a lot of respect for something like that, where if I'm, I tend to have a very high opinion of myself. But when I look at something from creators, I'm like, yeah, no, I couldn't do that. If you put me in the same spot, I couldn't do something this good. It's very telling to me.
Well, and to know this team has done it for $2, because I, again, like, I could see this being your one, like, say you know, for 10 years, you sit on a story and like you kind of over, you do it. And I've got this perfect thing like planned out and pitched out and like do it. But then to do it again, I think is like, you know, proof that it's clearly just like, you know, a quality writing all across the board. And I was thinking it uses like every aspect of the genre, whether I think specifically the kid mystery genre, like not only with the art, but the playing up the tropes, like anything that you expect from that genre, it uses, and then it kind of undercuts it. And like, it's unsettling throughout the book, the kind of stuff they stumble upon. But it's not, it treads that fine line where it's not like reductive of it. And it's not like over the top. Same with the Lynch stuff. Like I hate to keep saying that comparison, but like, I think so many people try to do that kind of odd, unsettling, and just miss the mark because they're just doing it to do it. And for whatever reason, like to be able to pull that off, I think this book does it because I think it understands very much kind of like with Lynch, like it's about the characters within that and the world and the theme. Again, like people love Twin Peaks because of the world and the background characters. And this story sets up, again, so many weird characters throughout the story, and they just kind of like live in it, and they're just there showing up. It reminds me of especially the kind of, there's a few scenes, I think the one you showed with the motorcycle bike, the is it the coach or the guy who sings,
the coach that assembly at the beginning, and they're like, another special treat for you, and then the coach comes out and he starts singing Build Me Up Buttercup, and I'm just like,
yeah,
what the fuck is happening here?
It reminds me of I don't know if it's around your time, but Pete and Pete, like,
I don't know,
just like, oh, so that's like it was a show on Nickelodeon, The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
I do know it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, but so like it's just like that kind of, it was like, again, very much kind of like that weird surrealness for kids, but it was like that, like where someone would just come out and do something, and like, again, that's
and what, like, you just got to live with it.
Yeah, and like the payoff at the end with the kind of like roundabout nature where that comes back with Dana is so good. It's
Like it's because it's been a while. I bought this, I guess it would have been it would have been like last year. It rushed around when COVID was starting, and I picked up these books, and you know, I read them and you know, immediately loved them. So I lent them to a friend of mine, and he had a pile of books, and I just never got them back for a while because he's away for the summer, and you know. That's fine. Like long-term lending is just sort of what you do when you're trying to get your friends to read your books. Read books. And so I just got them back this week. So I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to talk about this book on a podcast. So I got to get the stuff back. And he brought them back. So I read them again this week. And there's a lot of stuff I'd forgotten. But like that ending, I was like, wow, it's like, it's not something that's explained, like over-explained. It's not something that is, because I mean, like if I was doing that, I would 100% over explain it. I'd be like patting myself on the back on the page. It would be an embarrassment, but it's just there, and it's perfect. And it's really funny. Oh boy. But Bailey, going back to what you said about the Lynch stuff, is that I've seen so many things described as Twin Peaks mixed with whatever. And so many times it doesn't get beyond the surface level of that, where they're like, they go for like the aesthetic of Twin Peaks, or you know, whatever kind of like Lynchian thing they're going to do outside of like probably, but it doesn't get to the substance, because like the trappings are fine, but they're not what makes the thing the thing. You know, it's the actual, it's the substance, it's the, you know, evoking that particular feeling that, you know, this does so well that it goes beyond just set dressing.
Right. One and two, again, I think what this does is captures maybe the vibes of that and what works well, but it doesn't rely on that. And clearly like Chris has his own style and it works within that. Like I think of the, I don't think it's a spoiler because it's been shown some in the previews, but the guy they describe as the little man with the finger guns, who's like weird as fuck. But the, so like later when he's like, I did a police sketch of it, and then which in itself is great. Yeah. But then later on when they go around and they're like, have you seen this? They had another sketch of an elf with guns.
Yeah. Pauline, the hospital. And she's like, did you see this guy? And then she shows like a little, hang on, I got it right here.
Yeah.
It's like a little elf with guns in his
hands. Yeah.
And it's like, wow, Pauline, you did not understand what was going on. Yeah.
But like I think the little weird guy marching through a parade is kind of the Lynchian type thing. But then he doesn't kind of hang on that. He hangs on.
Yeah, but it's not something that's just lifted out of a episode of, you know, a 30, 40 year old TV show. Yeah, there's the guy. It's so funny because it just means that Nadine was not listening to Denny because nobody listens to Denny.
Oh, man, he had a good sketch. Yeah. And even that, like the ability to have like these very grotesque looking people who are just part of it. But then, I mean, clearly like Dana and Pauline and that crew are very like normal looking people. Again, just works to kind of that aesthetic where everyone is like very obtuse and overtly.
I mean, like, and like, I think one of my favorite characters is Dana's dad, Mr. Nance, because he's just like a dude who kind of looks like 80s George Michael, and he's just always up to something. Mm-hmm. And there's something about him I find really entertaining. Like you see him some more in the next volume, and he just is still very much the same character. And also, whenever you see him, he's always drinking. So he's got, you know, problems. But I like Mr. Nance for some reason. Have you read the second one yet?
I haven't, because I was like, I'm not going to be able to get ready for
it. It's revealed that he has a little flaming devil tattoo on his chest, which, like, awesome. That's character building right there.
And I would love to know. I think the artist is like very low key. I was trying to do as much, but like he clearly doing a style, because there's so many instances where like a more either refined or realistic aspect kind of breaks out. I think you see that with Sam's guardian. What's his name? Not Dylan. It's Dylan.
Like D-Lan or something.
The way he, represents him, and a lot of times he's clearly like this artist who is inhabiting this style. I would like to see more of what he does, but he's not around on a lot of social media.
Yeah. And you see that too with a lot of the stuff with Sam, the Tom Swift kid, where at one point Deputy Zyblocki, he thinks that, you know, Sam is the murderer, and he's kind of like, he's talking to Brennan, and he's talking just talking to Brennan, because Denny, you know, doesn't snitch. But he's kind of like laying at these situations. You see this like the sort of cartoony version of Sam doing these murders in like the story that the deputy's talking about. He's got these like really arched eyebrows, these big round eyes, in a way that's like really kind of reminiscent of, you know, like in Bone, when stuff gets weird and scary, you see kind of like that sort of exaggeration of feature, and it like works really well.
Yeah, I wish I pulled that bit, but there's the same where Pauline pukes, when she has like that first vision. It gets like super like detailed, like almost like photo realistic, and then it will pull back. I think like on all levels, everyone in this, like this again, like I feel like we're just saying the most positive things like you can say, and I never know how like helpful that is to people, but like,
I mean, I oh yeah, so good. There you go.
Yeah, like
that's so good. But also that it's, and then the puke is like in the shape of something, which is incredible. Like it's so it's so well put together, which is very similar to, is it when Sam and Pauline were at they're looking for Fleiss Palmer at the bars, and she like draws the raincoat and the water on the table, and then just like with a couple lines turns it into a skull. I was like, man, that's so fucking good. Like, it's just so good.
And like, there's, I think again, what is better than most stories is there's several reveals and there's several layers to the mystery. So like, you get kind of like a relief and a buildup and a relief and a buildup throughout the story. Like it's not hinging on one thing at the end. So there's like almost the end of every chapter, which you could essentially break it out into issues. Like each one has a really kind of unique payoff. And there's a lot of things hinging throughout it versus kind of it all coming down to like, again, one person in a mask at the end. I want to do like a Scooby-Doo reference, but like it's such a good like pacing throughout. Again, I don't know what else to say. It's like,
yeah, I mean, like I said, I've got nothing but positive things to say about it. It impressed me so much when I read it, where I thought it would be something I liked, but it just became something that I was just really just absolutely struck by. And like this kind of thing where it's usually a comic that came out like 20 years ago that I'm pick up. I'm like, oh wow, this is something I really missed. But like this came out like what, 5 years ago? Something. Yeah. And so like, you know, number three is in the works now, which I mean, who knows when it's gonna come out, but I'm very excited for it.
Well, and this is something that we've talked about a bunch, especially kind of the start of COVID and when kind of a lot of general publishing was kind of on hold, was like, this is a good time to catch up on more either underground or indie comics, because I don't think people realize like the vast amount of comics that are out there. And it is really difficult to find them. And that's like, literally, like I'm just sitting on Twitter all day. And that's mainly what I use Twitter for, is like trying to find new and different comics. And like, obviously Kickstarter has been a good avenue for that, but there's still these like, I mean, I always say it wrong. And we just talked about Piao, P-E-P-O.
Oh yeah.
Like they're just, you know, they're shutting down this year, and like they put out like tons of insane stuff that was great. And like, this is like another avenue that has gone. So it's like really, I mean, the stuff's out there if you want to find it. It's just a lot of times it's really difficult to find it.
I mean, I think that's part of, it's kind of like the downside of there being so much great indie work out there, is that sometimes it's hard, you know, sometimes stuff slips through the cracks. Sometimes stuff's hard to find. I mean, I really had no excuse. Like I'm pretty sure my comic shop guy was like, hey, you should buy this book. I'm like, not today. I've already got this other stuff I got set up. It wasn't until I saw those first five pages put on Twitter by that, sure was it, but that dude Minovsky, who is, you know, always putting great comic book content out there, you know, stuff people should be reading. And you know, I was hooked from there. Like, and that's why I'm always like talking about this book, because I want people to read it. I think it's a huge book. I think it's not a book that's gonna, you know, date itself or like, you know, age poorly. And it's something that people should check it out. Like it's, I mean, like I don't know. My copy's got a $20 Canadian price tag on it. $20 Canadian.
Well, it's like free in America.
Yeah, like it's like, I'm pretty sure in America you get paid for it.
Yeah.
So like you can't beat that for value. It's something you'll read over and over again. It's something that, you know, the art is, you're gonna keep looking at. It's something the story you're gonna keep going back to.
So, well, I think too, like what you said, like they do a thing that a lot of great movies and comics, which Cape Comics have the ability to do, but like nothing in it dates it. Like there is nothing really in it that wouldn't put it in a specific time period. So like you could read this at any point and it feels relevant.
Well, I mean, part of that too, though, is that's the thing about a period piece, where if you set something in 1996, I mean, this came out like what, 2017? If you set it in 1996, then it's always going to be in 1996. It's not going to be you know, hugely dated, because it already is dated. You know, by design, which is something I find really interesting. And it's something that I like about period pieces, because they kind of future-proof themselves to a certain extent. Like, I mean, some of the way the kids talk is not, you know, would not fly today. But, I mean, I remember, you know, I knew these kids in the 90s. You know, I was a maritime teenage dipshit in 1996. And that's, you know, that's the way it was. You know, kids, you know, smoking cigarettes and calling each other bad words. And you know, that's also one of the character takes I really like that we see established early on, is Dana smoking a pipe, and it's so funny, but it's so perfect for like that just like little bit of characterization. It's like she's, you know, the rich kid, she's, you know, the blonde, she's the one who like gets all the good grades, and so of course she like smokes a pipe while she leads the mystery club. Like it's really something about it just I find just delightful.
Yeah, there. Oh, sure. Where's the? It's the very first time you see her do it, where she's like, "What does that mean?" And it means like we have a mystery to solve.
No, not we have a mystery. It says, "I think we have a new case, chums."
Oh yeah.
Where is it?
And then like to, I guess to not just sit and say how amazing is all that. Like, there's so many like. So there's the part where they shoot is it the quail and the. Yeah. The beak gets blown off and like she places it on the paper mask. Like, again, the like level of visual storytelling this is, again, like I said, I think it under, I think the style they go for both in the story and the style of art is like used perfectly to kind of undercut the brilliance of the way they are framing things. And it, the cold open where he kind of reaches across the seat with the gun and like, the flame, like everything they do in this is like purposeful, like nothing, I think, like everything they do seems to be like well planned out and like
nothing is just wasted.
Yeah, there's the, like from start to finish in this book, there's not, there's again, there's not an ounce of fat on this book, I don't think. Like it is as close to perfection as I've read recently, and that's why I was like real pissed.
And I mean, like I'll admit I'm not much of a critic. I'm not particularly, you know, it's just not something I'm good at. But, you know, it's just, I'll read a book that if I like, I'll tend to focus on things I liked about it. But something like this, just from front to back, I just responded to it so positively. And I think it's a book, I'd love to see more people read it. Because that's why we do comics, right? It's why we're interested in comics. Because it's a medium that is widely accessible to people and is meant for as many people to read as possible, I hate to use the word consume in a positive way, but that's basically, you know, to consume this media and then have something in common, you know, something to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole, the reason we started this sister show or whatever was, again, like, somebody was just tweeting about it, I don't remember who, but, like, I don't know how important reviews are, especially for comics. It feels like a weird medium where, like, if I'm going to review the first issue of Black Cat, like, the story you're setting up isn't a one-issue story. Like, you're setting up an arc. So, like, there are things I could be like, well, this doesn't work for me in this issue. That's probably because the stuff I need for it to work is down the line. Like, you're telling a story, and it's specifically with arcs. And, like, I feel like reviews are not, I don't know if they're helpful, but I would much rather spend my time talking positively about comics, because not only is it more fun, but like, that's just generally like, I don't know, it's easier to do and it's more prohibitive of what comics are, because even like I've talked about, like when I stopped reviewing comics was I was reviewing Sex Criminals.
Right.
And I was like, the book wasn't for me. I didn't like it, but I was well aware that it was a good book. And it was like, again, it's like Zdarsky and Fraction, like they're writing a good book. I just didn't like it. So like, how do I review that? Be like, this book's not for me, but here's who it could be for. Like, that's not helpful. That's and like, yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, obviously I approach comic book reviews from kind of a different perspective, because basically the only comic book reviews I read are the ones of comic books that I write. And those can be very, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, very accurate, or like, you know, to my perception, wildly off the mark. But also I want them to be good. I want people to say nice things about the things that I write. Because ultimately I can think an issue is good, but it's, until it's out there, I'm not going to know whether it landed for, but also the thing with comic books, they have, you know, such a relatively wide audience that you're going to have one group of people saying this is the best shit ever. The other group of people saying this is, you know, horrible dog shit. And it can make your head spin trying to figure out which group is right. Which group are you going to listen to? Personally, I don't get into a lot of stuff where I say like, this is good, this is bad, just because I'm aware of how much of it lies in, you know, things that you like, personal preference. Like, I'm very happy to talk about things that I like. I just try to couch it less in the terminology of this is bad or like, this is good. Like, unless it's obviously something like obviously damaging, like, you know, I'm not going to read the continuing adventures of Adolf Hitler and be like, I mean, I thought this was bad, but maybe you would like it, you know, something like that. But just because I'm aware of how many things that I do like that a lot of people would think were kind of shit, like not on like, you know, a dangerous ideology or anything like that, but just because they don't like it. I'm trying to think off the top of my head what some of those things would be, but I can't come up with any sacrificial lambs.
I can even think, like, one of my favorite books is what, Prison Pit, and like that's clearly like such a niche type book.
Oh, here, I got one for you. The you remember Amalgam Comics, right? A book I've always loved, and I'm aware that it may not actually be very good, was the Amalgam Comics one-shot Assassin. It was like a real fucking like bad girl kind of cheesecake showcase. You had Dare the Terminator, who was like Daredevil mixed with Deathstroke, and Cat's Eye, who was Catwoman mixed with Elektra, and they're basically murdering their way from like the ground floor to the top of the skyscraper. And I remember that, I read that as a kid. I was like, man, this is like the ballerest shit ever. And now as an adult, I'm like, yeah, you know what? If I came to this now with no nostalgia, maybe I wouldn't like it so much. But, you know, I still really enjoy it. It's still something that makes me happy. Is it a good comic? I mean, jury's out. But is it a comic I like? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and as someone who's heralded the KFC trilogy as one of the greatest crossovers of
That's
all
true, right?
time,
I forgot about that.
which I stand by,
Hey, fair enough. I mean, I did
upon.
see that there
But
was
yeah, so
a.
if, I feel like if anyone's listening to the audio version, so at Chris, that's KRIS, Burton, BERTIN, just go fucking bug the shit out of that guy and tell him how great his book is, and definitely pick it up. Again, it's available everywhere, like bookstores, as far as I can tell. I know it's on Barnes and Noble discount, but I don't think
Hey, I heard it was a 40% discount. Is that correct?
that is correct.
Whew.
It's worth working a day there and spending your whole paycheck like at the end of your shift.
Man, I used to work at a grocery store. I got like a 10% discount. Some
What's
bullshit.
yeah, I worked at Target for like a month. At some when I was in high school, not high school, in college, and I think you got, I was like 5 to 10% or something, but it was only if you paid with cash or you could use their credit card or some bullshit.
Nice, nice, real cool, real cool.
Which, like in New York State, that covers like state tax pretty much. I think ours is like 7% or
Yeah,
stuff.
that sounds fairly embarrassing. Well, I
So,
mean, should be embarrassing for them.
oh yeah. I mean, they're Target. Everyone loves them.
Not in Canada, they went out of business.
Oh, you guys don't have Target? Well, you guys still have Toys R Us, though. You don't have Toys R Us?
R.I.P. Now, man, Toys R Us went tits up, didn't it?
They still had Canada stores. They kept that o kept those open.
I don't know about that one.
But I see. Well, because I have a bad habit of watching like toy hunts
Okay. I
where they.
mean, it's very positive, very possible I'm wrong. I don't think there's definitely not one in Halifax anymore. The one in Moncton, I'm not entirely sure, but beyond that, I have no idea.
But I don't know.
I haven't left my region of Canada for about a year or so.
I don't know how people shop. Like, I mean, I get you're probably used to the idea of your, like, obviously your money makes sense to you, but like the increased price. Like, I see them like shopping there and it'll be like, you know, we'll have like a $20 toy and it'll be like 45 Canadian dollars. Like, it seems, because my wife would love to go to Canada, but I'm like, seems expensive, but that's because I'm watching like toy hunts. I don't know if that's actually true. I'm like, based on my toy hunt
Yeah,
videos, Canada's
not everything
really expensive.
subscribes to the toy price point, but I mean, I'll be honest. Working for Marvel, I get paid in US dollars, which basically means I get a raise living. So it's great.
Okay.
Works out very well. Also, I have health care.
Oh, you get best, yeah, because you definitely wouldn't get that
Oh,
Marvel
in the United
kind
States, are you kidding me? I don't know how anybody like freelances in the US. It's wild.
Yeah, I don't know. I've long, it's because I work like my 9 to 5, like Monday through Friday job is a like I work at like a nonprofit specifically under kind of like our Department of Health.
Right.
It's so, like, I deal with like our the lowest of low, like the Medicaid users, and like it's fucking like that's our best healthcare, and it's fucking garbage. Like, so I don't know how anyone does it,
No.
but so if those are our greatest comic books of all time, where can they find more of your great comic books, Jed?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So what do we have coming up? Towards the end of the month, we have Black Cat Annual number one, the second Black Cat Annual number one of this run. Well, no, of my run, we'll say. So yeah, that's part of Infinite Destinies, which kicked off with Iron Man Annual Number One last week. So yeah, in that you'll see Black Cat story. She goes to South Korea. She gets tangled up with the White Fox. And also there is a backup with Nick Fury as drawn. So all right, sorry. The annual is with art from Joey Vasquez, colors from Brian Reber, letters from Farron Delgado, and then the Fury backup with Juan Ferreira, which is, man, Juan is just like tearing the roof off these Fury backups. It's amazing. So yeah, Black Cat is still ongoing. Next issue kicks off a whole new arc, the Infinity Score, which is towards the end of July. Also in July, we have Moon Knight number one, just kicking off. I'm very excited about it. Cannot wait for it to come out because I spent the last several months worrying if people will like it. So once it's finally out there, we'll get the verdict.
I mean, so then you probably know all about what Oscar's, same way that I would imagine, what they tell you for Black
Widow. I mean, Oscar's always on me, on my DMs. He's like, you know, hey, what would Mark do here? What would Mark do here? I'm like, you know, Oscar, just lean into it, baby. Just lean into it.
You're stealthily getting, like, the best, like, B-list characters. I don't say that, like, in derogatory, like,
oh, no,
again, Taskmaster, and then we've talked about, like, I think criminally underused, like, Fury, and then...
Yeah, I mean, Moon Knight. Moon Knight, I was in a position in the fall where, basically got an email about Moon Knight, where Tom Brevoort is like, listen, I want to put together a Moon Knight book. I don't really know what I want it to look like, so I'm just kind of asking around to see what ideas people have. If it's something you're interested in, let me know. Tell me what you want to do, and we'll see what we can do. It's like that day, I think I got the email and I was like at the grocery store or something. You know, you kind of like rip ass home and start typing stuff up and send it off. And eventually I got the job and I was like, man, I'm super psyched about that. At the same time, I think it was actually just before that happened, I was writing the King in Black, Black Cat stuff with Doctor Strange. I was like, oh man, it'd be fun to write a Doctor Strange book. And then I was like, wait, there's no Doctor Strange book out now. There's no Doctor Strange book announced. I wonder if they got it. So I started emailing around, like, you know, snipping about, trying to see like, oh, like, hey, I would really like to write a Doctor Strange book. Can I write a Doctor Strange book? And they got back to me. They're like, yeah, sure. We're planning to kill his ass, so you can do that. I'm like, all right, sure, dope. So at that point in time, I kind of had both things up in the air. It's like, oh, maybe I'm going to write Doctor Strange. Maybe I'm going to write Moon Knight. And I got both of them. Like, oh, man, I got to start working really hard here.
So but, I don't know. I mean, I've probably asked you before. But, I mean, as someone who's kind of, like, come into comics and you've been pretty much under that Marvel umbrella, have you thought of, or have you like thrown around the idea of independent stuff, especially like, you know, I was talking about like Hop Town stuff. Like, mm-hmm. Is that something ever down the road you could see yourself doing?
Oh, absolutely. It's, I mean, my career is kind of an anomaly in that I haven't done any creator owned stuff. You know, the usual kind of trajectory is that you do your creator owned stuff and that gets you noticed. And then you end up doing like the big two stuff. If that's what you want to do. But that's not really how I came up in it. So I have, like, I want to do a creator-owned book, and I'm kind of like putting ideas together for it, because after a certain point, you get a certain amount of freelancer anxiety where you're worrying about putting all your eggs in one basket, because, you know, I really love working for Marvel and it's a lot of fun working with these characters. But at the same time, I don't actually own any of these, the work that I put out there. So after a certain point, you got to start looking out for making sure you have something for yourself. So I think that's kind of be the next phase of stuff that I'm working on, is that gotta start looking at creator owned stuff, you know, having something that I own, or, you know, obviously own in part with the other people I work with, because I mean, you know, you're on comics Twitter, you know, you saw Herb Trimpy going around yesterday, and
the poor man,
you know, it's, I mean, you know, I came up on Herb Trimpy Hulk, like the guy was, you know, he's a legend, and if you got to make sure you got something for yourself. So that's kind of the next stage in the plan. Also, I hang out with Ed Brisson and Steve McNiven. They both live here, and they both give me shit for having never done a creator-owned book. So I got to do that so they'll stop making fun of me at a certain point.
And I mean, I love Ed is like one of my favorite like noir writers.
Yeah, I mean, he's
Chris might fucking ran the ropes around that on this book.
Sorry?
I said Chris might have run circles around Ed on this. It's so fun. Like, I was thinking of Ed when I was reading this. Like, oh, man, both of them are so good. But
I know, but the thing is, like, Ed's got to get a run on Daredevil, because I feel like that would be so up his alley, and like it would just be knocked completely out of the park, because like Ed's a crime guy through and through.
So I feel like Marvel is like criminally underused him as well. Like his skill set, obviously, like his books have been good, but like, yeah, again, kind of like the bread and butter of what he does. Like, there's so many characters that would fit that, and that I don't think he's gotten that chance yet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure at some point he'll have a go there, but like when you think Marvel crime, you think Daredevil, and I think that he would absolutely tear it up.
I mean, and if you do a creator-owned, I think it would just, it should only be a work to force Sheldon to do more art.
Well, we got the latest volume of Black Cat reprints that first story we did for Marvel, which I saw that in the solicits. I had to email Nick, the editor, and I was like, what's going on here? He's like, what? I need something to fill 8 pages. And I was like, all right, like it's a good story. Sheldon's work is amazing. I just worry a little bit looking back at my writing from 10 years ago.
That's true. But, I mean, you get Sheldon to over.
I mean, that's why I've always counted on Sheldon to kind of like support the weaknesses in my work.
Again, like I think the fact I was saying that to you, like the fact that Marvel has kept Black Cat going, again, for a character that, you know, doesn't have a movie, isn't really attached to like anything bigger in the universe, is just like proof positive of like your quality of writing, because it is like a book they would, I would see them cancel otherwise. So the fact that it has this like fan base and like quality to it, like you keeping that above that for that long is just like proof of the quality in the books.
Well, I mean, and, you know, to be honest, a big part of that is editorial. You know, Nick Lowe's been fighting for this book since day one. You know, he really believes in it, and he's really, really fired up by it. I mean, like, we cracked, you know, legacy numbering plus annual, we cracked 20 issues, which is wild. Like, a Black Cat book running 20 issues, like, that's bananas. And also, that's 20 issues with one overarching arc. Like, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, when do you get the chance to do that?
Well, that's like one of my favorites of like the last, I think it was during the Now or the Legacy or whenever one of their renumberings was the Hayden Blackman Elektra.
I didn't read that.
Oh, shit. So it's like Hayden Blackman and Mike Del Mundo when he was like coming up.
Right.
And it's like one of the best like Elektra stories. Like, it takes her as like an assassin and she teams up with the guild and like she's hunting. It's fucking great. But like, again, that was like this really unique story with these two kind of like unique voices and comics, and it got, I think, 10 issues, and they were like, cut it,
pull the plug.
Yeah. But they were able to wrap. But like, again, I think that's, again, speaks to the quality of the work you've put out. I won't keep bugging you for 2 hours. Podcast stuff, because I'll forget. We'll be back.
So officially, I beat Riley Rossmo for appearances, right?
I mean, technically, yeah. If you want to count this as a pages and panels, it is a pages and panels presents type thing. So
it's a pages and panels production.
Yeah, it is on the same feed. So I think feed wise, you are past Riley. But it's also because I have not bugged Riley, because I was like, that man is like, DC is like running him ragged with.
I love to see him out there though. Like, his Harley Quinn stuff is just like blowing up. And yeah, like I met Riley when I was doing a signing at a store in Calgary, and he just kind of turned up with donuts. And he was like, "Hey man, how's it going?" I'm like, "Hey, it's great. Did you bring donuts here?" He's like, "Yeah, you know." He's just like he's like one of the nicest dudes I've met in comics. He's like, "Yeah, you should just like let people know you're in town and get some comics people together." I'm like, I honestly did not think about that. I thought that'd be like, you know, trying to get out there big leaguing myself.
Yeah, he's like one of the few people that just will like still creator wise, like just goes to the shop every Wednesday and is like has his like book list that he's like checking off, and he's like, gotta get, yeah, I he's only done New York City, I think, like a couple times, but I went out one time because I would go every year. And like, again, I've talked to him a bunch, but like, I brought like this, the Cowboy Ninja Viking hardcover. And he's like, oh yeah. He's like, do you mind if I sign? I was like, yeah, sure. And he spent like fucking forever, like sketching this like big ass.
Oh yeah.
Just like casually talking to me. I was like, what are you like? I'm like, that like costs money. Like you're wasting money. Like you're Riley Rossmo.
Yeah, oh yeah. Like that's leaving money on the table. Like when I was doing that signing, I was like, oh yeah, right. You did that, the Martian Manhunter book with Steve Orlando. Like people really love that. I haven't read it, but I feel like I'm sure it's like, it's one of those things that I've kind of always been meaning to get around to read. And he's like wandered off back to his house and came back. It's like, yeah, here you go. Here's the series. Also, here's this Hellblazer book I did. It's like, shit, that's amazing. Thank you. He's just like the nicest dude. And like super positive.
And he's one kind of like we were talking about. Like, I remember his stuff coming out, like when he was doing like Green Wake and even like Cowboy Ninja Viking, people were like, his art was so polarizing this that like, cause he's like real sketchy and he's got cleaner, obviously. Especially with Ivan coloring him, but like, he was like one where like either liked him or you didn't. And like to see him become mainstream and like one of like DC's go-to artists is great. Yeah. Cause again, like I think his style's so unique.
Yeah. And like he puts it together. He works it in such a way that is like really, really exciting, but also really interesting. And yeah, he's one of those guys who's out there who's just doing his thing. He's just working. He's not giving anybody grief. He's not giving anybody problems. He's just happy making comic books.
Oh, and he's still using my avatar. So until he changes it, he'll be my.
There you go.
It's my one claim to fame is I made the avatar for Riley Ross on Twitter.
Look at this guy. I don't know. I've kept it as a point of pride that I haven't changed my Twitter icon in the 10 years I've been on Twitter.
Smart. It's brand management. As someone who,
I mean, it's bad brand management. It's the logo I made for my brother's band. He didn't like, so I'm like, fuck it, I'll use it.
Well, I know a picture you could change. I know a picture of you. You could change it to. Seems to be readily available all over the place. But again, as audio version, we do this, I don't know, every other, usually Thursday or Friday, depending on schedules. This week's Pages and Panels will be Chad Sell talking about Cardboard Kingdom. I'm doing it for I like the books, but that's my kids' favorite graphic novels. So we're doing those. And then Nicole Gu, and Dave Baker episode. The live version is up, and then the audio one should be up if you're listening to the audio version of this. But I think that's it. I'm not very good at the promoting or remembering stuff. I usually trail off on there. Kyle Overkill on Twitter. I think that's it. I don't know. We have a Pages and Panels Twitter, but I forget about it all the time. So don't check it out. So thanks for joining us. I'm going to end the broadcast.